Thank you, Bill, and thank you to Lenore for the invitation to be here today. Localism, despite what some people may think, seems to be in the air, doesn't it? I mean, you very likely have seen your hipster millennial barista sporting a I love localism t-shirt, right? And if you get the hipster millennial barista on your side, you know that things are moving in your direction, right? Or maybe it's just a fad. And the t-shirt will change and localism will fade, but I don't think that's the case. I think there is some compelling reasons to think that localism is a viable and important alternative to what we might see as the homogenizing forces of a kind of liberal cosmopolitanism that seeks to eradicate difference, reduce the entire world to a single entity. And it's also an alternative to the kind of retrenchment that has been suggested by some of our speakers into a kind of tribalism that most notably manifests itself today in identity politics. Localism is an alternative, I think, to those. But at the same time, I don't think we should think of localism as a kind of ideology. There are some people who espouse localism and then go around looking and insisting on purity tests. They are localer than thou types of people. And I think that's not very helpful because the world is a complex place. There's always trade-offs. But one of the things that speaking and thinking in terms of localism can do is help to provide us with the imaginative resources to consider an alternative to certain things that seem to be growing in our world, and even, according to some, are inevitable. As soon as someone speaks in terms of inevitabilities, just stop. Human beings are creatures who can make choices. We are not the helpless little artifacts of an inevitable logic of world history. Individuals and groups can make choices and can change things. With that said, I want to suggest that there are 6 features of localism. Now, this is certainly not an exhaustive list, but 6 characteristics that if we start thinking in these terms, we can better understand what a localist vision looks like. And the first is human scale. Scale is not something that we talk nearly enough about. But our artifacts, the things that we create, all have a kind of scale element to them. Think of a chair, for instance. We all can imagine the form of a chair. But if we get the form right but the scale wrong, the chair is not a chair in any effective way. Right? If it's 3 inches high, we say, well, it really isn't a chair. It's not capable of being what it's supposed to be. And if it's 20 feet tall, we can't sit on that one either. And there's a kind of range, an effective range, we might say, a scaled range that is proper to human beings. It was in the mid-20th century, the economist Willem Rupke, in his book Social Crisis of Our Time, had a little section titled The Cult of the Colossal. It's a nice-sounding term, isn't it? He argued that in a world that is increasingly finding it difficult to speak in terms of quality, all that we have left is the language of quantity. And how do you know if this quantity is good or not? Well, it's more than this quantity. We find ourselves speaking a kind of truncated language whereby well, this much is okay, but if we had more, that must be okay, or even better. And more is even better. It's an insane way to speak. In the early 1970s, another economist, E.F. Schumacher, published a book called Small is Beautiful. And he made clear he wasn't simply extolling the virtues of the tiny, as if he's the tiny house guy. But he did say that in an age that is so obsessed with bigger, we need a kind of corrective. And in that sense, small is beautiful. But when we're talking about human scale, we can think of scale, but that other term is important, namely human. And we're compelled to ask this question: what does it mean to be a human being? And I would submit that that is the quintessential question of our age. What does it mean to be human? The answer to that question will color everything that comes after. And as soon as we ask that question, we can ask, well, what's good for a human? Are there certain conditions that obtain that will foster the flourishing of human beings? Conversely, are there certain conditions that if they obtain will actually truncate or thwart human flourishing? Well, as soon as we speak in those terms, we're thinking at least in a broad sense in terms of teleology. Are there ends that are proper to human beings? Are there certain things that human beings ought to do in order to be the best kind of human being? This language of ends and human good suggests the second category or feature of localism that I want to talk about, and that's limits. Now, human beings have always, it seemed, have had a difficult time with limits, an uneasy relationship. After all, isn't the story that we see in Genesis chapter 3, you can understand that in terms of kind of pushing against divine limits, resulting in the fall. But so too, the story of Icarus is another example in archaic literature of an attempt to exceed limits proper to human beings and suffering a kind of fall. In some respects, we are, as a culture, at war with limits. And this is not something new. Indeed, if we think back to, say, the 17th century, in many ways, a century that signals the rise of or the birth of the modern world. We see thinkers like René Descartes and Francis Bacon, who in constructing their methodologies explicitly argue that we have to reject the authority of the past in order to secure the ends of knowledge that they imagined. In the 19th century, Friedrich Nietzsche finally gave voice to a disposition that had been growing for some time and declared that God was dead. And in the process, declared that any divine limit on human behavior was merely a fabrication of a priestly class seeking to control its helpless sheep over whom they exercise power. In the 20th century, and even in our own day, maybe most increasingly acutely in our day, we see attempts to reject limits that were once thought to be part of the very nature of reality. Indeed, we're told you can be anything you want to be, making human desire the final arbiter of all of reality. A parent that tells his or her child that you can be anything you want to be, well, it's telling them a lie. Setting the child up for a great deal of misery. We have rejected the limits imposed by a kind of authoritative past. We've rejected divine limits, rejected even the limits that are imposed and present in the structure of the natural world. In so doing, we have sought to eradicate any kind of authority over our lives, any limitation on our desires. It's kind of an orgy of divestment, if you will. A rage to liberation from all constraint. And in so doing, we've generated forces centrifugal, throwing everything from the center. I suppose it's not surprising. Yeats asks this question about the center not holding. There are various ways, specific ways, that we can think in terms of the limits that we exist with. Simple one. We have bodies. What does that mean? It means that we are limited to a particular space. Can't be more than one place at a time. Frustrating? Or just human? We're also mortal. Yes, indeed. Fair Beatrice must die. So will I. So will you. Why is it that we spend so much time, so much energy, distracting ourselves from that fact? It may, in fact, be that wisdom, at least in part, is only gained when we come to grips with the fact of our own mortality. It's a limit. Now, this language of limits, suggests another feature of localism, namely place. It was a few years ago at a dinner in Philadelphia, a retirement dinner for my mentor at Georgetown, George Carey. Some of you might remember him. Great man. He had made noises about retiring. So at an APSA conference, there was I believe ISI sponsored it, a retirement dinner. It was a nice dinner. We had a great time. He didn't retire. But I sat across the table from Jeff Nelson. I don't know if Jeff is here. And we were talking, and he said that he was interested in the idea of place as a kind of a conceptual theme. I'd never heard that expressed before. You mean you can actually think about place instead of just refer to places? Oh, indeed, you can. And I can thank Jeff, even though he's not here, for at least getting me to think along these lines. It was this idea of place is tied up fundamentally with the notion that we are embodied mortal creatures. We are not just abstract minds that can be anywhere at any time. It was Flannery O'Connor who, in a sort of snarky way, which was her habit, said, "Some place is better than any place." The particular places are important. We can't be citizens of the world. Global citizen, abstraction that means nothing, and actually can do a great deal of harm. I think the parable of the Good Samaritan can at least help us to think along these lines. You recall, Jesus tells his listeners, someone asked him, what are the great commandments, the most important commandments? He says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, body, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Well, that first one seems pretty clear. Love God with everything. But what about love my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? Jesus tells a parable about a man who is traveling from Jerusalem down to Jericho. It's in the Judean wilderness. It's a desolate place. And he's set upon by robbers, left for dead alongside of the road. A priest walks by, averts his eyes, doesn't want to get involved. A Levite walks by, does the same thing. And then a Samaritan comes by and takes up this poor, beaten man, puts him on his donkey, takes him to a hotel, to an inn, pays for his care. The Samaritan was not of the same tribe as the man who was hurt in the ditch. There was not a kind of tribal affiliation. In fact, Samaritans were despised by the Jewish people. So there's a kind of cultural separation. But what is present? What created a sense of duty? What created the neighborliness? Proximity. They shared the same space. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that all our moral duties are simply limited to the narrow proximity that we inhabit, the places we inhabit, but we miss something vital about our moral duties if we are so concerned with looking at abstractions, at humanity, and forget the bleeding and beaten and downtrodden person at our doorstep, in the ditch, next door. It's easy to love humanity. It's really hard to love your neighbor. I suspect that's why, well, lots of people talk about loving the world and loving humanity. It's easy, it's bloodless, and it's abstract. The fourth feature of localism, private property. I've heard some about that today. I might be taking a slightly different tack on this. But you'll recall in Richard Weaver's book, Ideas Have Consequences, he called private property the last metaphysical right. He thought it was the place within which conservatives could begin to turn the tide of a degrading and degenerate society. Why? Because private property is a kind of intuitive, immediately intuitive fact. The mindness of my property is not something I have to argue for. It is simply a kind of intuition. And Weaver thought this was a place to gain purchase. But property has undergone some changes. And as we saw this morning, there is a kind of centralization of property that may, in fact, be a problem. It was Karl Marx, can I mention Karl Marx from the stage, who argued that the bourgeoisie property was increasingly being centralized. He said this brought about a centralization of population, and with it, the centralization of political power. Marx understood something interesting, that the centralization of economic power goes hand in hand with the centralization of political power. They work together. And to just be against one is only seeing half the problem. That decentralization is an important feature, but we have to attend to the complexity of centralization. Now, of course, Marx argued that his revolutionary program would be launched when, he said, we win the battle of democracy. How do you win the battle of democracy if you're a Marxist? You proletarianize the citizenry. If you have a majority of citizens who are proletarian, that is, nomadic, propertyless wage earners, feeling insecure about their futures, one step away, one paycheck away from disaster, what are they naturally going to look to? The only source that seems to be willing to help, namely the government. How will they vote? They will quite reasonably vote for policies and politicians who promise to alleviate their insecurities. Social Security with small s's, not a program in a specific program, but a general disposition, is going to be perfectly reasonable in that sense. The 20th century economist Joseph Schumpeter notes that when property is changed from a kind of solid, real property to a more abstract form, in the sense of stocks and bonds, that he says this takes the life out of property. That people begin to think of property differently. Here's an example. I own a 401k. Maybe some of you do as well. Where is it? I have no idea. I can't go visit it. I can't beautify it. I can only make it go bigger or smaller in terms of quantity. I can't even protect it. If someone was going to take my 401k, I don't know where to go to defend it. It's abstract. I'm not saying I want to give it up, but it is a different kind of property than, say, my house. I've got a porch. I've got a house. I've got a little field, a couple steers. If someone wants to come and take my property, well, I know how to defend that. Right? I can stand on the front porch. And being in Virginia, not Chicago, I have means to defend myself, if you know what I'm saying. There is a difference in those kinds of property. I can beautify my property, my real property, my land, my home. I can touch it. I can invest in it in a way that will transform it qualitatively, not simply quantitatively. Schumpeter was concerned that as property moves in this more abstract direction, it will become increasingly centralized. As capital moves in this direction, it becomes centralized. And eventually, there will be a kind of overthrow of capitalism into socialism. Which is really interesting, given all of the talk about socialism today. What's the solution in terms of property? It seems that there are only two. One, limit the franchise to only those who own real property, because they will think about property differently. Some of the colonies in the early America did that. In terms of our current state of affairs, that's a non-starter, right? Do we all agree with that? That's not going to happen. What would be the alternative then? It seems that it must involve the reinvigoration of a middle class that is constituted by people who own real property. How does that happen? There's no easy way, but there, and we even talked a little bit about this morning, there may be ways that this can be done, certainly. Any kind of laws or regulations that serve to consolidate capital are not helpful in this regard. What's really happening here, what I'm suggesting is, there may be a political reason, not an economic reason, but a political reason for the decentralization of property. You want to keep your democratic republic from being consumed by the policies that are pushed by a majority of individuals who are proletarian? You have to dispense with and eliminate the proletarian class. It's interesting, Tocqueville, writing in the 1830s, argued, in America, there is no proletarian class. Everyone possesses property, mostly in the form of land. That's not the way we are constituted today. So it's going to require some very serious thought in order to make something to reverse courses in this matter. Fifth principle of localism is community. The writer Robert Nisbet writes of what we might call the psychology of belonging. He says we all long for membership. We long for rich personal attachments. And one of the things he's concerned about is the corrosive effects of the nation state on the secondary associations that are the natural source of those affiliations. The nation state tends to be corrosive of those and leaves in its wake an array of individuals detached, insecure, alienated, and lonely. And in its place, in the place of those secondary associations, the nation state steps in. So that what we have here is individuals comporting directly with the nation state. And Nisbet argues that what we need is a revitalization of the secondary associations. Tocqueville argues that the art of freedom is nothing other than the art of association. And he thought Americans were genius at these habits of associational life. Community is essential because we are creatures who are not individuals, but we are persons. Persons who are shaped, who are not fully who we are if we are not in community with others. I would submit there's even a theological aspect to this. Christian theology teaches that God is triune. God is not an individual. He is a community, perfectly ordered within himself. And as we are created in God's image, we find ourselves like God in the sense that we are built for community, but unlike God because we're not sufficient unto ourselves. We're naturally suited toward, built for relationships with others. In this sense, the language of individualism or independence is something we need to be very careful with. We can look to be economically independent so that we can care for our families, and so that we can care for our neighbors in need. See, it's outward looking. Interdependence may be a better choice of words, that we are built for reciprocal actions, one upon another, human on human, person on person. Another feature of community is shared memory. Tocqueville writes in his long chapter on race relations in America, three races in America, he says, the Anglo-Americans, the Native Americans, and the black slaves. Something interesting about his analysis of the situation of the Native Americans and the black slaves, and that is both by forces out of their control had been deprived of their memories, and as a result had been deprived of a sense of identity, which undermined an ability to really know who they were in the world. Separated from the past makes it very difficult to have a coherent vision for the future. It's Nisbet who argues that totalitarian regimes always set themselves a task to destroy memory, to destroy the past. You want to control a people? Destroy their past. We are, after all, storytelling creatures. Aristotle says, well, man is a rational animal. Maybe just as, and even more true to say, we are creatures who tell stories. What stories do we tell? Well, in the context of a local community, we tell our own stories. We repeat the stories. You know how old people are? They like to repeat the stories, right? Tell them over and over again. And the young people, I tell my students this, you should listen to your grandparents. You've heard the story again before? You've heard it over and over again? Oh, yes. And I listen. Why? They are ingraining in you your story. The story of who you are. Not as an individual, but as a member of something bigger than yourself. That is not simply a snapshot in time, but extends into the past with an anticipation of a future together, continuing that narrative. You, young people, I would say, are inheriting something, a story. You have a responsibility. Build on the story and tell the story. This is what identity is. And it may, in fact, be something of a problem for us today, where we don't tell our stories because we're too busy watching the stories written by other people in Hollywood or Madison Avenue, and in the process ignoring the stories that our parents and grandparents are bursting to tell. Six. And final principle or aspect of localism is stewardship. Our previous speaker spoke a little bit about that. What does it mean to be a steward? Stewards aren't owners. Stewards are recipients of a gift. But it's not a dead-end reception. If it is, the steward has failed. Stewards receive something that has been passed from generation to generation, lovingly cared for in many instances, sometimes bought with a dear price, and it's dropped into your lap. There's a transmission. There's a reception. But it's not a passive reception. A good steward is one who receives lovingly and gratefully, and takes that thing that's been received and cultivates it. Tries to improve upon it. Always with the mind that it's not mine. It's something that I am caring for. Stewarding. For whom? My children, grandchildren, and generations not yet born. If we think of ourselves as stewards, suddenly the limits of a kind of narrow temporal horizon is extended. If we think of ourselves as receptors, receivers, recipients of good gifts, long tended, carefully guarded, we become aware of the past and the way that the past bears on us. The responsibility we have to people who are long dead. And if we think of ourselves as stewards, as we look to the future, we can recognize that we have duties to people not yet born. That's not how we tend to think today in a digitalized world where every snapshot, every second is seen as a completely new creation. We need to extend our temporal horizons to recognize that we are part of something larger than ourselves, that we are recipients of good gifts. we are tenders of those gifts, and with loving care, we transmit them when the time is right. In this sense, localism is really inseparable from love. But it's not an abstract love for the world in abstract terms. It's a love for particular stories, particular places, particular people that God in His providence has placed us with. Because you don't get to choose where you're born. You don't get to choose your family. You don't get to choose the stories that you are born into. But you are burdened nonetheless with a duty to those. Of course, you can shirk your duty. But that's not what it means to live well. This account of localism that I'm presenting here provides, as I said at the beginning, an alternative to a sort of homogenizing liberal cosmopolitanism. And it also provides an alternative to a retrenchment into tribalism that's most recently taking the form of identity politics. Because this account of human life that I'm describing is not one that is characterized by hating other places and other people, but of loving your place and your people. It's characterized by a recognition that all of us, all humans, are embodied souls created in God's image and therefore possessing inherent dignity. This is alternative I want to call humane localism. It's not the tribalism, us against them. It's recognizing something deeply human about the limits that we encounter, the places we inhabit, and the communities of which we are part. It's characterized by a love and affection, and shaped by gratitude for what we've received. Gifts that we didn't ask for, which is simply another way of saying grace. Thank you.
Jonathan Ashback, Hillsdale College. Thank you for your thoughts, Mark. I wonder if you might clarify something that you said about limits. Localism embraces limits. And I could understand you as meaning one or both of two things by that. There are a number of non-moral limits, if you will, on human beings. You mentioned our embodiment. But I imagine all of us traveling here use technology to transcend the natural limits on our capacity to travel, and that's morally legitimate, not a problem. There are also moral limits. There are things that I could do to myself or ways that I could go about doing them that would be morally problematic. So when you say that localism embraces limits, I could understand you meaning either that it's accepting of the moral limits on human existence. I could understand you also as meaning that it embraces a sort of contentment even with those non-moral limits that one is unable to overcome. And I was wondering if you meant the first or both of those, or do you have a different conception of what that means?
Well, I haven't in this talk developed a kind of full-orbed account of limits. And there are certainly, and I don't want to not deny this, things that have been impediments to human flourishing that we have, by virtue of our ingenuity, practice, practical experience, transcended. The hard part is knowing exactly what limits are things that ought not to be pushed against. Simple example. It's becoming increasingly likely that we can, through medical procedures, manipulate the human genome at a very fundamental, in a fundamental way, to change characteristics in future children. Is that a limit we should respect? Well, I think we should have that conversation. And it doesn't seem obvious to me that simply creating a better race of human beings by virtue of our technological whiz-bangery, that's a technical term, whiz-bangery, is something that we ought to do. So I'm certainly not saying, hey, don't try to break the 100-meter dash record, because that's just a limit. No. Those are things within which a human being ought to strive. And this really just goes back to a question of what does it mean to be a human? We need to get that right. We have to think very seriously about philosophical anthropology. And once we have that well circumscribed, well described, I think some of these other questions become easier to answer.
Thank you.
Hi, Mark. Dan McCarthy from the Fund for American Studies and Modern Age. I have a sort of practical question to put to you. You've cited Robert Nisbet and Alexis de Tocqueville, both critics of centralization and the national scale. Mm. But right now, it seems as if globalists are facing a difficulty because there are forces larger than the nation state that are also having a disintegrating impact upon localities. And it seems to me that in many respects, radical libertarians would agree with some of the criticisms you've made of the nation state, and they would prefer to see localities kind of exposed to a global market.
Yeah.
So in this conflict that is very politically salient right now between nationalism or economic nationalism on the one hand and a libertarian market globalism on the other, what is a localist to do?
That's a great question. What's a localist to do, right? That's a good way to put it. I think the idea that as espoused by certain libertarians, that what we need is to dispense with nations, dispense with borders, and let free flow of labor and markets and so on is naive. The human beings are complex creatures, and we naturally, despite the Good Samaritan and the moral requirements that are imposed upon us by virtue of the teachings of Christ, it seems to me that we are naturally inclined and suited to smaller units of affiliation that are tied to nationality or to language rather, and religion specifically, which is just another way of saying culture. Right? And so I don't think it makes any sense to dispense with the nation state, but I do think it makes sense to, as much as possible, defang the nation state in favor of some kind of federalist structure recognizes that the proper scale of authority is somewhere below the nation state. In local communities, whereby exit is easier to accomplish, make the libertarians happy, but where interests and goods that are proper to local communities can be respected. One of the problems with a kind of centralized power, whether it's national or international, is it seems to be hopelessly allergic to the possibility of idiosyncratic behavior. There needs to be, and this is more possible on the local level, the ability to tolerate, idiosyncratic individuals. Here's an example. Maybe it may sound silly, but you all know the Andy Griffith Show? All right. Yeah, we all know it. Otis Campbell. He's the town drunk. And he's a problem because he's the town drunk, but, and I'm not saying the world is Mayberry, But here's the point. Otis Campbell is a town drunk, but he's our drunk. And we'll deal with him. We'll give him the keys to the jail, and we'll try to help him. But we're not going to institutionalize him. We're not going to drive him out. We'll tolerate him. And I think that can be accomplished in the context of this humane localism where authority and power is decentralized to a great degree under the auspices of a federal system. In other words, I think Madison's Constitution is not a bad idea.
Hello, Michael Spinner Watson, Belmont Abbey College. I believe what I'm about to say is complementary to your argument.
Okay.
So commutative justice or exchange justice is where you can be a global citizen. Buying and selling, prices are formed, merchants back to the ancient times could transact across borders. We don't necessarily have to have personal knowledge of each other. Yeah. We can live in an anonymous society almost and trade. But when it gets to distributive justice and social justice, it seems the local becomes more important. So when I say social justice, I mean associations formed together to meet a common end, yeah, not the other forms. And distributive justice, specifically the gift, where I give the good to the other, I need to have knowledge about that particular person, which cannot be described by prices. Because with a gift, we have no demand curve, and we perhaps have a supply curve, but it's being given freely. That's the nature of a gift. So no prices form, and so we need tacit knowledge and other forms of knowledge to properly gift. So the local is inherently important most of the time with distributive justice and social justice, but with commutative justice, exchange justice, it becomes, you can have that anonymous global society more so.
Yeah. I think that makes good sense. And I loved your use of the word tacit knowledge. Being someone who spent a lot of time with Michael Polanyi's work, but what tacit knowledge requires is a kind of embodied knowledge, right? It's knowledge that's acquired through practice, that is not something that can be abstracted away from the particular circumstances. And so I think, yeah, that makes good sense.
Thank you.
Hi, I just like to share a few of my thoughts and hear your response.
Okay.
I enjoyed your speech very much because your speech, every single idea in your speech resonates with a piece I wrote. I too am deeply influenced by Edmund Burke, McIntyre, Roger Scruton, and Tocqueville, so I understand every single thing you say. But I'm very pessimistic. So localism understood as a philosophy or principle, as far as I see, it's impossible for society to practice it nowadays. I mean, for instance, the place, the relationship of your identity and the place you were born in, the story you were born in, it's easy for the founding era people understand because they own land, the old land, and they cultivated, they invested in the land, whereas nowadays people, they rent apartments, they move around.
Yeah.
And also community, I mean, nowadays people, they largely live in the virtual world. They don't really have this real person contact. So in terms of localism as a principle, it's just, as far as I see, it's impossible to practice it. I see that with tremendous sadness, but that's the reality I see. I just like to hear your response to my thoughts.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
First of all, don't be despairing. Don't be pessimistic. I don't think you need to be optimistic either. Optimism isn't a virtue, but hope, as you recall, is a theological virtue, and so we don't want to despair. But a couple things. Given circumstances right now, the way that we shape our lives, live our lives, you're right. There's so many forces that are pushing in the other direction that it looks, I wouldn't say hopeless, but it looks like an uphill battle, right? But never forget that historical circumstances change. And sometimes they change very rapidly. And One of the things, or two points. When we talk about localism, expressing it in a conference like this, that's all well and good, because what it can do is create, call it the imaginative space for seeing an alternative. But what I hope it does, further than that, because that's the first step, but what I hope it does is ignites some in some people an idea that, well, here's a little thing I could do. See, what's never going to happen, that is, everybody say, okay, now we're localist, and everything changes. But what happens when you go back to your town, and you go back to your town and community, and you say, how can I better foster a sense of community so that there are ties being formed that are lasting? How can I think about friendship differently? How can I think about how I spend my leisure time, how I spend my resources? How can I be different? How can I, as an example, show my children an alternative? Create that alternative, that imaginative space. And here's a little thing. Start a book club. What happens when you start a book club and you meet once a month with a group of friends to read a book? It seems so humble. Yes, it is humble. And localism is not a grand program. Well, there's never going to be a presidential candidate running on the localist ticket. Because in our current situation, that'll never happen. Because we are, in a way, have developed a taste for grand strategies, grand programs, and we have come to see the small, the local, the humble as well. It just doesn't matter. But it matters for that little community with that group of friends who are meeting regularly and having a discussion that's meaningful and teaching their children around the table things they've learned in this little discussion and modeling every day in little actions and choices an alternative. Should we expect something bigger? As soon as we start thinking we need a program, we're already thinking in the wrong way. What we need is a different imaginative picture of the world. We need to see the world and the possibilities in our own particular places differently. And it's not going to happen quickly. And it may never sweep the world, but it can change your life. Can change the life of those in your community, and never underestimate the value of thinking small.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm Joe Johnston. I'm also from Virginia, from a small town in central Virginia, and I absolutely identify with what you were saying. I think all of your points about localism are excellent. In fact, it put me in member of the late Mel Bradford, who is well known to at least the older members of this society. And Mel wrote eloquently on the subject of localism and subsidiarity and all of the, I think he basically would have supported all of the points that you were making, especially on stewardship. And I just remember one statement from one of his essays, and I can't remember which one, in which Mel said, "Every man is arbitrarily assigned a place and the responsibilities that go with it by his ancestors, by his forebears, and by the history of his people. He must either cope with those responsibilities or be destroyed by them." And I just wondered if you had encountered Mel's works in your thinking about this subject.
I have not in the context of localism, but I would certainly welcome some citations, because the way you expressed it is better than I could.
Yeah. I'm Bill Bonner, attorney from Philadelphia. Back home, the challenge that I encounter, and I do appreciate your remarks very much, and I agree with them, but the challenge that I encounter is a number of men who, when they get honest with one another, share the fact that they've got a child who says, you're a bigot, you're intolerant, and worst of all, you don't agree, and that means you hate. I see a lot of that. I encounter that repeatedly, and I'm wondering whether in the process of the academy abandoning the teaching of the meaning of life, that what we really ended up with is a culture which subscribes to rights, and that rights trump the stewardship of values, which is the essence of what a man might give to a child, passing on ultimate values. But the child is not looking for values. They're looking for rights. And they can't subscribe to our values because they can't see beyond our rights.
Yeah. No, it's a great point. And part of the problem is, and I said that we need to start with an adequate philosophical anthropology. If we simply see human beings as centers of will without an essential nature, the language of rights can't be grounded in anything meaningful. And what we have in our current cultural moment is a situation in which the language of rights is preserved, but it has come to merely be a means of creating a kind of moral validation for the expansive appetitive desires. If I'm in a debate with you and I've got a desire, an appetite, and I can make you think that I have a right to its fulfillment, to its satiation, well, it seems like I won the debate because right seems like I have the trump card there. But it's a desiccated conception of rights that has no grounding and has no limit at all. It can be expanded in whatever direction our desires can go. And that's a dangerous moment. And it's one in which rights language has become and is increasingly becoming debased in that sense. And you're exactly right. We need to think more in terms of duties. And I just make a final pitch. Yes, the education system is badly broken. What we need, as our previous speaker said, is a reinvigoration of classical, Christian, liberal arts education. And we need to teach our children that they are inheritors of something that is valuable. Civilization is not natural. It is an achievement, and they are recipients of this achievement. And if they take it lightly, if they squander it, if they think it's simply natural and something that is their right, they will lose it.